The news about the climate has been fairly grim of late. Our weather patterns alone should tell you a few things about climate change, and then there are similar reports of weather disruptions around the world. And the official reports, report after report of how dire the situation is getting from the IPCC and other bodies. It's understandable that some of us want to run and hide from the news. Our guest this hour urges us to do the opposite, to get busy. Paul Hawken is the author of Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. Paul Hawken has been a major voice in the environmental movement for some time. He's in demand as a speaker and panelist and has written 8 books, including Drawdown, a detailed plan for reversing global warming. Paul Hawken, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Paul, you there? We really like our new system when it works, and it doesn't at the moment, or at least Paul's not there, so we're going to raise Paul on the phone. And again, the book is called Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. It is a detailed description of the issues so far, and it is a final work of Paul Hawken as author and project director, but with a very large staff under him, with a whole bunch of researchers and scholars. I count 15 in all here. Contributing writers, there are about a dozen of those. Essayists that also have some additional input here, including Jane Goodall, who gives the preface to the book. Jane Goodall, we know from her work with chimpanzees over the years. And so all kinds of great work in the book from a lot of different names and people, and that's what led up to the idea of Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. We're going to get Paul Hawken on the phone now, just not as fast as we'd like. And so one of the things I can tell you about the book is that one of the first things that Paul Hawken says directly to us as readers after Jane Goodall's foreword is the idea of agency, the fact that that we can take action, that it is not just, and we've heard this urging from other guests as well recently, the idea that it's not just about waiting for somebody else to do something or feeling helpless and not knowing what to do and therefore doing nothing, but there's a lot of stuff that can be done. And the book goes on to set up a lot of information about great places on the planet, great ecosystems, how they are to be preserved, and the things that we can do to preserve them. And it goes on through all these descriptions, not just of the places, but also the people. And finally, we get to some urges to action in the back of the book with some very, very specific places to go to do things to be able to feel like you're having an impact on climate change, because it's going to take everybody working together, all, 8 billion or so of us now, to do something about this. And once we get Paul on, you can join the conversation at 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760 on the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org, and Paul Hawken is there. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Yeah.
Good to have you here.
I was there, but somehow the system didn't allow us to connect. So I was listening to you. Thank you so much.
Okay. Yeah, we've run through this before. I'm going to have to kick that little thing out the door until we can actually be heard on the other end by the people we're talking to. So the big question first, one generation, really?
Well, one generation means that we are going in the right direction at the right rate by 2030, one generation in 2040. And it doesn't mean that we've solved it, it's over, we can go back to business as usual. In fact, that's the last thing we want to do, because business as usual is what is the cause of global warming. But it does mean that we know where we're going. Things are coming together, and the metrics are there, and we can see the impact that regeneration is causing with respect to both atmospheric and also biospheric changes. Those changing in degeneration, we're degenerating here on Earth, and we're also degenerating in terms of climatic stability. And so, in one generation, easily.
Wow, easily, you say. Okay, so as you point out, though, the Earth will come back to life no matter what. I presume that's not necessarily with us aboard.
No. That's the thing about regeneration. You know, regeneration is innate to life. It's innate to us, by the way, each of us. Our 30 trillion cells are regenerating every nanosecond, or we wouldn't be talking. But it's the default mode of nature, of life. Life creates the conditions for life. That's what life has always done and still will. And so we can strip and burn and poison and acidify and, you know, deforest, et cetera, the earth, it'll come back. It comes back rather quickly, by the way. Our concern isn't the earth as such, so much as our relationship to it and civilization as a whole. That's what's in question right now. Our ability to sustain civilization and lives that are meaningful and are not fraught with disaster and conflict.
Well, all right. So this is where we get to an interesting point, because we are talking about civilization and people and society. And you say solving the climate crisis is an unnatural act for humans. So how do we take the first step to do something unnatural and start moving in the right direction?
Well, I mean by unnatural act, and that is that it's been positioned all along for 40 years as a future existential threat. And it was interesting listening to your comments before I went on about, you know, weather, smoke, temperature, fires, you know, which is that it has changed from a conceptual threat, that is a concept. Oh, okay, good. I understand. Thank you. To experiential. And when I was involved with at Stanford Research Institute in the 70s, and we were schooled in what was happening with climate change, everybody kind of nodded sadly that we didn't expect anything to happen until it was experiential, which then might be too late. And that's pretty much what's happening. I think we really hit at an inflection point this year, especially with the sixth assessment coming out, which was unanimously signed on to by every nation in the UN framework of climate change. That had never happened before. There was recidivists, you know, Russia, Venezuela, China, Saudi Arabia, and the U.S., by the way, and who wanted the things to sort of be tamped down, not so extreme, quote, quote. And this year, they all signed on as code red.
We were talking about the most recent major report, the sixth report, and I forget what it's a series of, but the one that basically said it is code red. Things are looking really rather dire for the planet. Did that give you, think, Paul, a greater push to a lot of people to do something?
Well, I think the sixth assessment did a couple things, novel things. One, it was unanimously signed on to by all the member countries. Second, it came out at a time when the Northern Hemisphere was on fire. And from Siberia to Greece to Spain to Canada to Oregon to California, and many of these fires were unquenchable. That is, they could not be put out. And some of them are still burning to this day, of course. And so that was new, you know. I mean, I used to live in the Sierra Nevadas, and we had fires, and we were volunteer fire people, and we knew what to do in terms of, you know, fire the lanes and this and brakes and wind, and, you know, we didn't freak out. I mean, it was dangerous in some cases, but it wasn't a freak out. And the difference now is the dryness and the wind. Those are the conditions that are causing these extraordinary fires that we're seeing. And so that happening at the same time as the release of the IPCC and then being further amplified by Hurricane Ida, where more people died in New Jersey than Louisiana, where it hit. Definitely these kind of things are either vicariously or directly allowing people to understand that this is the real deal, and it's not a concept, it's not future existential threat, which was really how it has been and talked about for decades, you know. And the fact is, you know, we do not respond to future existential threat. Our brains aren't wired that way, and that's why it's an unnatural act. But it is a natural act for us to respond to current existential threat. And that's what's changing, and that is what needed to change, unfortunately, you know. But that's where we are. And I think the climate movement, whatever that means, and I'm not sure I know what it means in myself. I don't mean like an NGO or people marching in the streets, but the movement being the movement towards reversing global warming and addressing the core causes of it and so forth will become the biggest movement on Earth. And the reason for that is weather. I'm not a person, not some charismatic leader, not some organization, nothing. No, it's weather. And so we're all going to move towards that. And the question is, how do we organize? How do we coalesce? What do we know? where the most effective things we can do, not the most effective thing to do. And I'm going to make a distinction there, because some people oftentimes think, well, what's the most important thing to do? You know, well, the most important thing to do is what lights you up, what really engages you, what really makes you want to wake up in the morning and do it or be involved with it. I mean, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I can't wait to mitigate, you know? I mean, and so we sort of, I was an altar boy, I was brought up Catholic, and we had, you know, a good share of guilt and everything we learned from catechism, from the nuns and so forth, you know? And that is not a way to motivate people, guilt, you know, shame, blame, you know, which is the language that's been used, you know, along with fear and threat and so forth. And you mix those words together, stir well, and then have basically these phrases like we're going to combat, you know, climate change, we're going to fight it, we're going to tackle it, you know. I mean, which gender do those words come from? You know, we know those are male sports and war metaphors. And what's wrong with those is that they othered it. It's like it's there somewhere out there and we can fight it, you know. And that othering language, of course, you know, is redolent in our society today. Me too is othering anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, racism. These are all othering terms and ways of seeing the world. And we cannot look at this as something that's other that we can fix, like Bill Gates. Oh, I'm going to fix it. What's it? There is no it there. And the Earth is one system, and the biosphere and the atmosphere are contiguous, gaseous and solid, but one. We just have different names for different aspects of it, but it's one thing. And the fact is, and this sounds maybe surprising for people to hear, the climate today at this moment is perfect. It's perfect because nature never makes a mistake. The climate we're experiencing is a response to what we are doing down here on land. And so forth. So we should stop thinking we're going to fight it, you know, as if it is an object, you know, that is separate and different, and look to each other and look to what we do. And that's, again, what regeneration is trying to pivot, that kind of languaging that has, to your question, why are we so disengaged? Why are we so remote from it? Why don't we take it seriously? Why don't we do something? Well, the way we've communicated it guaranteed it.
Paul Hawken is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is called Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. And so you've talked about the othering, and which gets us into realms of how humans treat each other. And as you say in the book, social justice is not a sideshow to the emergency. Do you mean we need to heal society to heal the planet?
I don't think there's any separation between regeneration, whether it's in a city, people, cultures, indigeneity, forests, land, oceans, coastal wetlands. I mean, regeneration holds all of that, and they're inseparably linked. So it's not like we have to just, you know, the social justice is often spoken about now in terms of people living in low-lying areas and who don't have resources and so forth, you know, are paying a higher price, you know, than those who are well off and so forth. But actually, injustice is the cause of global warming, not an artifact of it. And because if you look at the economic system we have, whether it's an intentional, unknown, inadvertent, it makes no difference. It is an extractive system. And by extractive, it means that when you go down the supply chain of any company or any service provider, you will find that what it does takes life. It takes life. That is, it kills life. And that's degeneration. And what your weather report and what the news cycles are telling us is that we can see the end of the road to a degenerative economic, cultural, socioeconomic system. We can see that. It's there. It's in the headlines every day. And so regeneration is like, is that working for you? I don't think it's going to work for us. It's like, can we do a 180? And do we want to continue to steal the future from our children, you know, and really virtually from ourselves? Or do we want to have an economy, a social system that's about healing the future? Because we can have a prosperous, beautifully run managed economy with GDP and dignified, meaningful, purposeful jobs by healing the future. But that ain't where we're going when we steal the future. And so regeneration is really about all levels, but it's about seeing what we do, not with blame and accusations, you know, not with, you know, I'm right, you're wrong, but seeing possibility, because what we're hearing about all the time is the probabilities of what's going to go wrong and get worse faster than what has already happened. And you can only take that so much before you just want to disappear and pull the shade down. And probability is right. It's good science, and the science is impeccable. But we need courage here, not hope. What we need is, like, got to science. Wow, it's a bummer. Woo-hoo. Yes, and the scientists are extraordinary. Thank you very much. Now let's get to work. Let's do. Let's go at it. And that's about possibility.
Paul Hawken, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, his latest book is Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. He says, yes, we can do this. It's going to take a lot more working together than perhaps we've done of late. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Our phone number is 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, I'd like to just briefly state what my view of what's going on here with this subject, and that is we have for a very long time in the Western world suffered under the Descartesian lie, I think, therefore I am. And what we need desperately to do, even on an individual basis, is to keep a balance between actual mental quiet and activity. And we don't do that. And because we don't do that, then Paul and other people who put books together have to write yet another book. And I'd like to hear what Paul's response to what I have just said. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Carter.
Well, I think everybody needs a practice. A prayer of mindfulness, of devotion. I think it is, you know, like coming home, if you will. But at the same time, what we know from neuroscience and so forth is that our beliefs do not change our actions. And it's action that changes our beliefs and changes the beliefs of other people. And right now, it is code red. And so the most important thing to do is to act and to do, as opposed to, you know, postulate and cogitate and, you know, whatever. And it doesn't in any way exclude what you're talking about, you know, the caller talked about in terms of self-reflection, mindfulness, prayer. And in fact, if anything, we need much more of that, you know, so that we come to the world and to each other with a sense of respect that is largely missing in the dialogues, at least certainly in the political dialogue and the cultural dialogue.
It's interesting because we talk about, you've been talking about the interconnectedness of things. The fact is that, mm-hmm. you know, we heal society, heal the planet. They are the same basic process. It seems like we could probably find agreement on the fact that we want to care for the planet, but it's weird that we get into these situations where we don't seem to care much for each other.
It is true, and we even have disagreement about caring for the planet and so forth, and that's because we are have a political system based on fear. And so, you know, opposing candidates try to figure out which fear will create the most votes. And so in certain areas of the world, certainly in America anyway, you can create fear about the people who understand climate taking away your jobs and taking away your car and taking away gasoline and warm homes and there won't be cold beer and they can use all these ridiculous types of fear-mongering, you know, and just butcher the facts and so forth. Okay. And then on the other hand, you have people who understand the science, but they also can use fear if we don't do this, we don't do this, we don't do this, this and this and this will happen. Okay, so we have a political system based on fear, not on coming together and understanding. Okay, and so we talk about the politics industry in the book. We're the only climate book that talks about industry, the plastics industry, the clothing industry, the poverty industry, the politics industry, and so forth, and big food, etc. As that these things need to be regenerated and renewed and restored and changed just as much as our forests, our oceans, our ecosystems, and our cities need to be regenerated. And so, again, we're connecting dots that maybe should have been connected a long time ago, but which seem to me obvious. And so I just feel like the way I see it is that we're being homeschooled by the planet. You know, that's what's going on. It's giving us feedback. Any system that ignores feedback will perish. And we are and have been ignoring it. And again, the question is why, and can we look at this in a different way and engage in a different way such that people want to be involved, they wake up to it, they are excited about it, as opposed to feeling, well, we're screwed if I don't, which is not really a strong motivation to do something. I mean, it is a motivation, but it's a negative one. And I think that regeneration, being innate to what it means to be a human being, is something we can tap into. And I want to say, too, that regeneration is a burgeoning movement. Been around a long time in the environmental movement, sustainability movement. I've never seen anything take off, grow, emerge, duplicate around this area, and the whole area of the environment and climate as this one. And so we basically are pointing to an emergent quality and direction and activity of humanity that's going on the planet right now.
A couple of emails here, one lighthearted and the other one with a more serious question. Gary, No Town Given, writes about he's going to get a T-shirt made that says, "I can't wait to mitigate." He really enjoyed that from you.
Send me one.
And Chris in Medford writes, "It seems that people are inherently selfish. Can we reverse climate change if we have a selfish gene?"
We do have a selfish gene, and that's about survival. You know, very point well taken. And one of the reasons that the bulk of humanity, I use the number 98, it's actually greater than that, but 98%, is because the climate solutions have been basically don't touch their lives. And they don't benefit, and they don't see the benefit, and they don't experience commercial economic benefit from it. And so, like, yeah, they're going to ignore it. Most of the world wakes up every single morning. I'm going to say the majority of the world, 4.5 billion people, I think it's more than that, with worrying about current existential threat, not the future existential threat. And they wake up worrying about health, about food, food security, security overall, their children, can they get to school, is it safe to get to school, about, you know, jobs, about income, about, I mean, that most of them wake up with that every morning. We're privileged. We don't necessarily understand that. You know, we may have had that in our lives at certain periods, but then those go away. But this is chronic for most of the people in the world. So what is extraordinary, if you go to regeneration.org, and there's a section called Nexus, and it's about the world's largest and most complete listing and network of climate solutions and how to do them, all right? But if you go there and you look at all these different solutions, they're in drawdown, they're in regeneration, other sources, and you look at them, and you didn't understand climate change, you didn't understand why, there was not a climatologist alive, the science didn't even exist, that extreme weather was just seen as anomalous. There was no amplification or cause or relationship to a warming world. And if that was the case, we would want to do every single one of these solutions because they have cascading benefits for people, for children, for prosperity, for health, for soil, for abundance. I mean, it just goes on and check, 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 check. Human well-being, the well-being of all the creatures and critters that we depend upon, in terms from pollinators to beavers, you know, to fisheries, etc. And so we don't need to understand, like, the science to know that these things are really beneficial and exciting. And when we bring the world back to life, when we regenerate life on Earth, we are bringing ourselves back to life. And that is so necessary now, because most people, when you do surveys, you go deep, they don't feel that, other than taking care of the family, they don't have a purpose, no overriding purpose in their life. And that is a cause of such pain and anxiety for people. You know,
that's quite a chord you sound there. The idea that anybody who's worried about roof overhead, next meal, next paycheck, etc., is not somebody who really is in a position to think about a health of the planet overall. This is a real short-term kind of focus, but that's the focus for so much of humankind.
Yeah, it's a fact. It's just the way it is. And in the poverty industry section, and I write it, say, poverty is an industry. A condition is a condition for the individual, but basically, if we want to understand poverty, you just have to go upstream and see who's benefiting from it. And poverty is cause. Poor people don't cause poverty. And the fact is that, I mean, when we look at how many people are poor and impoverished and don't have what they need to fulfill what they need on a daily basis, what they want on a daily basis, you know, in terms for their self, nutrition, health, education, their children, etc., clothing, warmth, etc., so forth, that this actually is a pathway to reversing global warming. We see them as sort of marginal and like, okay, but, you know, it's going to be people like, you know, Bill Gates and, you know, in the Billionaires Club and big companies and so forth. Well, I'm not decrying anything they're doing, but I'm saying is that unless we engage, unless we create the conditions for self-organization so that the poor want to fix poverty themselves, they don't want somebody from the north or coming in and fixing it for them. That is patronizing. They want dignity and meaning and purpose just like the rest of it. And that is what these solutions, these techniques, these practices, these technologies offer all of us, but they also offer it to the world's poor. They offer a way to change their lives, their destiny, and also provide them a sense of meaning. Because if there's anything more meaningful than regenerating life on Earth, I don't know what is, you know. I mean, come on, you know, especially given where we are and what we know at this time.
Well, I want to come back to the income scale at the other end in just a bit, because there's a point you make in the book about philanthropy. Right now, I want to take a call from Aaron in Arcata. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Hawken, the author of Regeneration.
Hi. So I'm going to take a little longer than I normally do, because I need to say you've been a superhero of mine for at least three decades. I was at the Alternative Energy Project at Cal State Dominguez back in 1979 through 81. Amory Lovins and Hunter came and guest lectured a bunch. Buckminster Fuller guest lectured a bunch, and I got to be mentored by him during that period of time. And you like essentially partially created another superhero of mine, which was Ray C. Anderson with Interface. So I just needed to say that before I started to get into the point today. So I'm going to try to lay things down. I'm mostly talking to Paul, so everybody hang on. I want to talk about the good reason that humans have, and specifically in the first world, for screwing up. We have technologically over-leveraged ourselves, so that's the first thing. That's why I say the first world, because we have the machine power in all manner, virtual and physical and the rest. And for the majority of human existence, linear change is the way things have been. It's the way to bet. And so what we have is a lack of imagination when it comes to exponentials. We're now in a super wicked problem age. And the word super there doesn't mean super big. It means us, our worldview, or our involvement and dependency on the existing programs keep us locked in. As Mencken said gazillions of years ago, meaning about 100 years ago, it's hard to get someone to vote against their paycheck. So this brings us to things like, I'll just use an example, and I'll input Chris Conrad, who is probably the nation's hemp expert, president of the the Industrial Hemp Association. He's no longer that, but he was one of the founders. So in Hemp Lifeline to the Future, to sum up the whole book, he points out that if you take any building you might be standing in and replace everything that you can with hemp materials, you might have a little steel and a little copper left. Most people don't realize this. They don't understand that you could make polycarbonate like we do for greenhouses, commercial greenhouses, which replaces glass, and then everything else as well. The wood, most people understand. Cement, they're starting to get just like this. So what would we do if we actually took that information and wanted to make it March? Well, we would grow as much hemp as we can to seed, and then the next year we would replant the seed. And we would do this for 3, 4, 5 years until we had enough seed to distribute to everyone who had any place to grow some hemp at all. And then we could begin to like move in a much larger, now again, another reference, Gaviotis. The reason Gaviotis isn't the village that was invented to save the world, even though it was, is because there was a war down there in Colombia, and most people still don't know about Gaviotis. Mm-hmm. They don't know the successes that were demonstrated by that team and that community. So we can do this, as Paul's been pointing out, but again, there's a good reason that our imaginations are failing, not on just dealing with exponentials, but with multiple exponentials that are reifying each other. And so each one accelerates even beyond the normal exponential curve, the growth of these vectors that are, cracking our global supply chain and our way of doing business. And this brings us around to why we're not going to do anytime soon growing as much hemp and to seed and repeat rinse and repeat. And it's because our governmental officials and the people who elect them have a failure of imagination, because linear change has been the way it's been, and it's the way to bet. But right now, it's entirely in the way.
Okay, Aaron, I'm going to stop you there because about 4 minutes now, we're going to need to get Paul back in here to talk about his response to what he's hearing.
Well, thank you, Aaron. Thank you for the nice comment, kindness. I can't address everything. I'll go to a couple areas. One is about regeneration, because I want to stick to my subject here, which is, what does that mean in terms of buildings? Well, in terms of buildings, it means, because you brought it up, it means two things. One is that the buildings don't emit greenhouse gases, and that has to do with energy, the source of energy. And the building itself, the embodied energy of the building, that is, the embodied carbon, the building of the building didn't emit greenhouse gases. And CERA, which is S-E-R-A, which is one of the biggest green architectural firms on the West Coast, I don't know if they're bigger on the East Coast, or they're all, but they do amazing buildings. They're building low-cost, mass timber, affordable housing right now that is zero emissions and embody carbon in terms of operation. So you're seeing whether it's hemp or whether it's mass timber or whether it's, you know, glams or whether it's this in the building industry, what you're seeing is a whole industry move towards buildings that are actually carbon sinks instead of carbon sources. And so this, again, is emblematic of what I was saying earlier, to Jeff about really this is a movement that's happening on all levels and so forth. And I would say in terms of linear, not quite, you know. I mean, you see, look at the growth of renewable energy, wind and solar. I mean, it is growing and changing the rate of its use and utilization in the world, and the rate at which costs go down. In an exponential way.
Let's see. Becky, no town given, sent an email to say all the major world economies seem to be based on growth, in quotes, and growth is viewed as success and prosperity, but this is often tied to extraction of resources, coal, forests, fisheries, etc. It's heartbreaking to see communities that bear the brunt of boom and bust. I live in one here in Redwood Country. How do we actually stop this cycle and find another way? Thanks, Becky.
Yeah, well, that's what regeneration is all about, is like, what he's talking about is company stealing the future, and a paradigm, economic paradigm that does the same and reinforces it both by investment, by capital, by concentrations of capital. And all I can say is that is not going to work for very much longer. And as I said, the climate movement will become the biggest movement in the world because of weather, because of impact. And those paradigmatic approaches to nature, to the world, to forests, to land, and to people are going to be seen for what they are, which is extractive and destructive.
Back to the income scale, because we talked about how you mentioned poverty as an industry and that, you know, poor people don't create poverty. People create poverty. So let's talk about the other end of the income scale. You say in the book, philanthropy must declare a climate emergency. What do they need to be doing that they're not doing now?
Giving away all of their money, not just earning money in the stock market and giving away, you know, earning 8% a year and giving away 5% and growing their endowment. I mean, this is a climate emergency. Act like it. And the other thing about the top 10%, the top decile of income earners in the world, that's over 38,000, by the way. If you make more than 38,000, you're in the top 10% of income earners in the world, actually emit 56% of all greenhouse gases. So, you want to look for a cause, there it is. You want to look for... It, to me, what I believe is that the world that we consider to be, you know, impoverished or localized poor deserves to have a higher carbon footprint, and we need to really look at what we're doing very seriously. And there are ways to do this that we can reduce it. I mean, there's a punch list on our thing, regeneration.org, and it shows you what effects and impacts you can have in your life as agent, not just as an individual. So to me, this is a wonderful opportunity for us to understand, you know, our relationship to the living world and to the economies, what Becky was talking about, and to pivot. And it's all about pivoting 180 to a world where we put life at the center of every act and decision. That's going to be a better world, a more prosperous world, a more kind world, a more compassionate world, and it's a world that we can be proud of every day, every night, and we can wake up to and be glad that we're a part of, and part of doing that and creating that.
You mentioned the punch list, and you do provide samples in the book and online. And the sample punch list, for example, by a homeowner would be to install heat pumps, stop all fossil fuel use in my home, cooking, heating, and hot water. Number two, get an induction cooktop to exchange.
That's
to
my
replace
punch list, actually.
What's that? That's your personal punch list?
Yeah, that's what I put in first.
Uh-huh. And how much have you gotten the whole list covered?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's in process. I started just a few months ago. But it's so interesting because we use Pacific Gas and Electric here, which has really implicated many of the bad fires in California. Was, you know, PG&E not taking care of their transmission lines very well. And so my reward when this happens, I have solar on my roof already, so it's renewable energy. When you use heat pumps, it's 50% less energy to do the same thing. But to call PG&E and say, hi, would you please take your gas meter off my property? that's going to be a red letter day. It's going to be so great for me to have that conversation. But I'm working with my neighbors to do the same thing. In other words, we're all involved with it, you know, and looking at the costs, suppliers, the plumbers, you know, where the best units and all that sort of stuff. We're learning, and that's what is also on the regeneration.org site, which is climate action systems, which are learning pods. We learn well together. We solve problems well together. We're social animals. We'd like to do it that way. And again, that's where there's excitement. That's where there is, you know, where we find what unites us is far more important than what divides us.
So we have to remember that we actually do get along and do better when we're working together.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Indeed. Paul Hawken, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a longtime voice of the environmental movement, the author of many books. The latest is called Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. You can find the same concepts online at regeneration.org. Paul, a pleasure. Thanks for joining us on the Exchange.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
All right, take care.